In the tumultuous years before World War II, as Hitler's shadow spread across Europe, a parallel movement was taking root on American soil. Rachel Maddow's prequel uncovers this forgotten chapter of history, a time when American fascism wasn't just a fringe ideology, but a movement with powerful adherents in business, politics, and society. This New York Times high number one bestseller has resonated deeply with readers seeking to understand the historical precedents for modern threats to democracy. Celebrities from Jon Stewart to Stephen King have praised its urgent relevance, with King calling it both enlightening and deeply disturbing. The book's exploration of how democracy can be undermined from within has made it required reading in political science courses nationwide, as it reveals how close America once came to embracing authoritarianism and offers sobering warnings about the fragility of democratic institutions. George Sylvester Viereck, author of the world's first gay vampire novel, seems an unlikely character to emerge as Hitler's master propagandist in America. Born in Munich and immigrating to America at 11, this self-proclaimed sensualist who worshipped Oscar Wilde alongside Napoleon became Germany's most effective agent on American soil. His journey from literary provocateur to Nazi operative reveals the strange bedfellows that fascism created in pre-war America. During World War I, Viereck had defended Germany even after the Lusitania sinking killed 124 Americans. When a forgotten briefcase exposed him as a paid German agent, public opinion turned against him. Yet by 1940, with Hitler's portrait proudly displayed in his office, Viereck had established himself as the architect of Nazi propaganda in America. Nazi Germany spared no expense, Viereck later boasted about the lead-up to World War II. In summer 1941 alone, they distributed over 1 million leaflets, 2.5 million pamphlets, and 135,000 books across America. When the German embassy was eventually shuttered, it still held $3.5 million in cash, approximately $75 million in today's currency. Viereck's genius lay in exploiting weaknesses in American law. Nothing prevented foreign governments from funding American sympathizers, and he leveraged this loophole masterfully. Nazi agents funded publications and shortwave radio stations, spreading messages that America was corrupt, Roosevelt was a warmonger, and Jews were a menace. Their American allies included intellectuals, architects, politicians, religious leaders, and dozens of congressmen who distributed over 3 million pro-German mailings under their own names. What makes this history so chilling is how openly these operations ran. Viereck didn't operate in shadows, but in plain sight, understanding that America's commitment to free speech could be weaponized against its own democratic foundations. His propaganda network reached into the highest levels of government, creating a fifth column that worked tirelessly to keep America neutral while Hitler conquered Europe. The question that haunts us, could such influence operations succeed again today when our information ecosystem is even more vulnerable to manipulation? Philip Johnson, the Harvard-educated aesthete who would later become America's most celebrated architect, stood among the crowd at a Nazi youth rally in Potsdam in 1932, mesmerized by Adolf Hitler's oratory. Despite his frail physique and stutter, Johnson had adopted the bearing of a superior being, heavily influenced by Nietzsche's concept of the Übermensch, individuals beyond conventional morality. Johnson's fascination with fascism wasn't merely academic. Back in America, he compiled a secret list of 200-300 sympathizers for his Gray Shirts organization, an American counterpart to Hitler's Brown Shirts. Though only about 20 people ever attended meetings, Johnson's wealth and connections made him dangerous. He used his position at the Museum of Modern Art, where he paid his own salary as head of the architecture department, to legitimize his political activities. Many who knew Johnson dismissed him as flighty, silly, or harmless, just a wealthy dilettante causing trouble. But Lincoln Kirstein, a Jewish contemporary who shared Johnson's Harvard education and aesthetic sensibilities, recognized the dangerous undercurrents. While Johnson promoted European fascism, Kirstein's Jewish connections through Felix Frankfurter were already warning about Nazi brutality. Johnson wasn't alone in his fascist sympathies. Lawrence Dennis, a handsome former State Department official whom Johnson admired, emerged as America's leading fascist intellectual. Dennis advised the Gray Shirts that Senator Huey Long might be America's best hope for fascism, calling him smarter than Hitler and our nearest approach to a national fascist leader. What's striking about these figures is their respectability. They weren't marginalized outcasts, but educated elites with access to power and influence. Johnson and Dennis moved comfortably in America's upper echelons, using their credentials to legitimize fascist ideas. Their story reveals how authoritarianism often gains a foothold not through obvious thuggery, but through the intellectual justifications provided by society's best and brightest. Isn't it disturbing how easily extremist ideologies can be normalized when presented by those with the right pedigrees? The pattern continues today. Extremism wrapped in credentials, hatred dressed in respectability. Johnson's later reinvention as America's architectural darling, with his Nazi sympathies relegated to a youthful indiscretion, demonstrates how easily society can be persuaded to forget uncomfortable truths when the packaging is appealing enough. By 1934, Huey Long had emerged as President Roosevelt's most formidable political opponent, embodying what post-democracy strongman rule might look like in America. His Share Our Wealth movement promised radical wealth redistribution, with a progressive tax structure reaching 99% on wealth above $8 million, a populist message that resonated deeply during the Depression. Long's Share Our Wealth Society counted nearly 8 million active members across 25,000 local clubs by the end of its first year. Unlike many populists who only offered rhetoric, Long had a track record of delivering concrete results in Louisiana. 2,500 miles of new roads, 40 bridges, free textbooks, literacy programs, and state hospitals serving all citizens regardless of ability to pay. But these achievements came at a devastating Democratic cost. Long had completely dismantled Louisiana's checks and balances, controlling all elections and appointments, stacking every level of government with loyalists, and operating like a mob boss with everyone kicking up to him. "I am the Constitution," he declared without irony. For fascist intellectuals like Lawrence Dennis, Long represented the perfect strongman who could harness the discontent of the people to end America's Republican government. Philip Johnson became so enamored with Long that he and his associate Alan Blackburn created the National Party in late 1934, designing flying wedge emblems and heading to Louisiana to offer their services to be Kingfish, even fantasizing that Johnson himself might eventually become the American Hitler. When Johnson and Blackburn arrived in Baton Rouge in early 1935, they found Long increasingly unreachable, moving about with a growing cadre of armed men that screamed dictator in any language. His security detail had evolved from a single state trooper to dozens of armed thugs who frequently roughed up reporters. Photographer Leon Trice was beaten twice, once thrown down marble stairs, while Long stood by laughing. From his 24-story Art Deco Capitol, Long controlled Louisiana completely, transferring authority from cities to his puppet governor, Oscar Allen, collecting kickbacks, and enjoying the high life with custom silk suits and Ramos gin fizzes at the Roosevelt Hotel. By September 1935, Long was pushing legislation to make it illegal for federal officers to exercise authority in Louisiana not explicitly granted by the Constitution, the broadest and boldest defiance of federal authority since the Civil War. Long's assassination on September 8, 1935, left a complex legacy. Though deeply corrupt and power-hungry, his focus on economic inequality resonated widely, as did the schools, hospitals, and infrastructure he built. The Washington Post noted his deep sincerity for the dispossessed, while warning that his career epitomized the essential weakness of democracy, the pathetic willingness of the electorate to trust a glib tongue and a dynamic personality, calling him a forerunner of American fascism. What makes long stories so relevant today is how it demonstrates the fragility of democratic norms when confronted with charismatic populism. When a leader delivers tangible benefits to supporters while dismantling democratic guardrails, many citizens willingly accept the trade-off. Haven't we seen similar patterns emerge in recent years, with populist leaders worldwide eroding democratic institutions while maintaining passionate support bases? Long's Louisiana offers a cautionary tale about how quickly democracy can transform into autocracy when we prioritize results over process. In 1933, as the Nazis sought to make life intolerable for German Jews, they looked to America for inspiration. Young attorney Heinrich Krieger was dispatched to study American race laws at the University of Arkansas, where he documented how over 30 states' Jim Crow laws provided a model for Nazi Germany's legal framework. Krieger discovered that American presidents had long advocated racial separation. Jefferson and Lincoln had expressed hopes that black Americans would be shipped overseas. Woodrow Wilson had resegregated the federal workforce, and Calvin Coolidge had signed radical immigration restrictions after publishing Whose Country Is This?, warning against racial considerations too grave to be brushed aside. What fascinated Nazi legal scholars was America's use of juridical Umwege, secret, twisting passageways of reasoning that circumvented constitutional guarantees of equality. Despite the 14th Amendment's explicit language, American courts had developed a bouillabaisse of artificial line drawing that privileged whites while maintaining the appearance of legality. The Supreme Court's insular cases had determined that territories like Puerto Rico belonged to but were not part of the United States, creating nonsensical distinctions that nevertheless served racial hierarchy. This American legal approach directly influenced the 1935 Nazi Law for the Protection of German Blood and German Honor, which criminalized marriages between Jews and citizens of German blood. That same year, after protesters in New York removed a swastika flag from the German ocean liner SS Bremen, the Nazi government formally adopted the swastika as Germany's national emblem, with Hitler publicly thanking President Roosevelt for denouncing a Jewish judge who had criticized Nazi symbols. The uncomfortable truth is that America's racial hierarchies provided both inspiration and legitimacy for Nazi policies. Hitler admired how America had conquered a continent, subjugated non-white populations, and maintained white supremacy through legal mechanisms that preserved the facade of equality. As historian James Whitman has documented, Nazi lawyers explicitly cited American racial precedents in drafting their own discriminatory laws. This history forces us to reconsider American exceptionalism. Rather than standing apart from the authoritarian impulses of the 20th century, America's racial practices helped inspire them. The legal architecture of discrimination that America had perfected over generations, the ability to maintain oppression within a nominally democratic framework, provided a blueprint that the Nazis eagerly studied and adapted. Doesn't this historical connection make you question how we teach American history? We often present Nazi Germany as a unique evil that emerged from nowhere, yet this evidence shows how American practices influenced and enabled Nazi legal thinking. This isn't to equate the two systems, but to recognize that America's racial hierarchies were so effectively codified that they became a model for the 20th century's most notorious regime. In September 1936, young reporter Arnold Severide, later known as Eric, infiltrated the secretive Silver Shirts organization in Minneapolis. Despite being just 23 and fresh from the University of Minnesota, Severide easily gained their trust, discovering they had enrolled nearly 6,000 members statewide. Unlike social clubs, they were vigilantes preparing for violent confrontation, stockpiling supplies for an imagined communist uprising while spreading anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. The Silver Shirts were led by William Dudley Pelley, a failed screenwriter and publisher who had reinvented himself as America's aspiring Hitler. Born in 1890 to a deeply Methodist household, Pelley described himself as a perpetually hungry, shabbily dressed, and none too happy youngster forced to begin working at 14. Though physically unremarkable, 5'8", 150 pounds, with a Van Dyke beard and rimless glasses, he possessed storytelling talent that earned him early publication success. Around 1930, Pelley pivoted to a lucrative combination of charismatic Christianity and the occult, claiming supernatural experiences, including a near-death vision, a beam of white light entering his skull while reading Emerson, and a divine revelation on a train. These experiences supposedly transformed him physically and spiritually, eliminating his need for alcohol, tobacco, and caffeine while improving his physique without exercise. Most significantly, he claimed to have become a human radio receiver, able to communicate with souls in the fourth dimension. When these spiritual ventures failed financially, Pelley found a new direction. On January 31, 1933, the day Hitler came to power in Germany, he launched the Silver Shirts, claiming he'd been secretly organizing this great national organization since 1929. Unlike his failed spiritual movement, this fascist political organization was fueled by hatred, particularly anti-Semitism. Through his weekly publication, Pelley promoted elaborate conspiracy theories about Jewish plots for world domination. Remarkably, over 15,000 Americans joined, paying dues and receiving silver shirts with scarlet L emblems for love, loyalty, and liberation. Members took an oath of consecration, received weekly mailings, and were instructed to keep arms ready. Pelley's presidential campaign featured armed rallies where silver shirts stood at attention in their uniforms. The candidate himself wore military regalia with an ammunition belt and was surrounded by bodyguards. At a July event at Deutsch's house in Los Angeles, Silver Shirts and German-American Bund members heard speakers attack Jews, with one lieutenant declaring his only criticism of Hitler was sending too many Jews over here. Pelley himself strutted silently for 2 minutes before speaking, then denounced the Moscow-controlled and Jew-infested Rosenbelt administration and promised to march up the steps at Washington and show them this is still a Christian nation. What's most disturbing about the Silver Shirts is how they combined religious imagery with violent anti-Semitism, creating a toxic blend of Christianity and fascism that resonated with thousands of Americans. This pattern, wrapping extremism in religious language, continues to this day. The Silver Shirts weren't just imitating European fascism, they were creating a distinctly American version that appealed to religious identity and anti-communist fears. Doesn't it make you wonder what might have happened if economic conditions had worsened rather than improved in the late 1930s? Pelley's movement gained 15,000 members during the Depression's darkest days. How many more might have joined if America's recovery had faltered? The Silver Shirts remind us that even in America, democracy's stronghold, fascist movements can gain significant followings when economic anxiety combines with racial and religious grievances. While American fascists organized openly, one man created a remarkable counterintelligence operation to fight them. Leon Lewis, a Jewish lawyer and World War I veteran, had been running a secret spy ring in Los Angeles since 1933, committed to fighting rising anti-Semitism in America. As the first national executive secretary of the Anti-Defamation League, Lewis recognized the danger when Hitler rose to power and Nazi groups began targeting disgruntled World War I veterans on the Pacific coast. Despite his efforts to engage law enforcement, Lewis found little support from authorities. Los Angeles Police Chief James Two Gun Davis dismissed him, declaring, "Hitler's only trying to save Germany from the Jewish problem, and that every Jew is a commie and every commie is a Jew." The Los Angeles County Sheriff similarly rejected Lewis's concerns, while the local Secret Service claimed they couldn't act without the commission of some overt act. The FBI, focused obsessively on communists under J. Edgar Hoover, had compiled a 2,000-page file on Charlie Chaplin while ignoring the fascist threat. Left with no official support, Lewis created his own intelligence network. He recruited non-Jewish veterans to infiltrate Nazi and fascist groups, gathering evidence of their activities and plans. The toll on Lewis and his operatives was severe. Lewis's law practice suffered tremendously, while his first spy, John Schmidt, faced death threats against himself and his family after agreeing to testify, eventually suffering a nervous breakdown. His successor, Charles Slocum, infiltrated deeper into Nazi fascist operations than anyone before, uncovering horrific plots, including plans to hang prominent Jewish men in Los Angeles and shoot up Jewish homes in Boyle Heights. When these conspirators partnered with the dangerous Leopold McLaglen, the plot expanded to target celebrities like Jack Benny and Charlie Chaplin, with plans for synchronized firebombings and ship bombings. In April 1938, Lewis and Slocum secured a crucial piece of evidence, Henry Allen's briefcase after his arrest for possessing a kike killer weapon. Inside, they discovered correspondence revealing widespread fascist conspiracies with connections to German consul Manfred von Killinger and plans to purchase the Ku Klux Klan lock, stock, barrel, crosses, and sheets for $75,000, making it part of the American Nationalist Confederation, an organization that had adopted the Nazi swastika as its symbol. Lewis's operation exemplifies what the Jewish tradition calls tikkun olam, repairing the world. At great personal cost, he and his agents documented fascist activities when official agencies refused to act. Their work eventually provided crucial evidence for later federal investigations, though Lewis himself never received proper recognition during his lifetime. This remarkable story raises profound questions about citizenship and responsibility. When government institutions fail to protect vulnerable communities, what obligations do citizens have to organize their own defense? Lewis chose to fight fascism through meticulous documentation rather than vigilantism, creating an evidence trail that would eventually help authorities understand the threat. His story reminds us that sometimes the most patriotic act is to document threats to democracy that official channels refuse to acknowledge. John F. Cassidy, a 24-year-old Brooklyn native with a law degree from St. John's, had once applied to become an FBI special agent, but was rejected for having an insipid personality and limited ability, lacking in initiative. Yet when Cassidy presented himself to Father Charles Coughlin at the Shrine of the Little Flower Church in Michigan, America's most famous clergyman happily arranged a leadership role for him in the Christian Front. By 1938, Coughlin was increasingly convinced of a Jewish communist conspiracy destroying America. After his failed 1936 foray into presidential politics, Coughlin pivoted to explicit anti-Semitism, even serializing the despicable Protocols of the Elders of Zion in his magazine Social Justice. His reach was astonishing. His weekly radio audience represented nearly a quarter of the U.S. population. After Kristallnacht in November 1938, Coughlin shockingly claimed Jews had brought the violence upon themselves, calling Nazism only a defense mechanism against communism. When WMCA Radio demanded advance review of his sermons, Coughlin's followers formed the Christian Front and picketed for 38 straight Sundays. Cassidy joined the front as Coughlin began calling for a Franco-style armed revolt, claiming theological justification through Thomas Aquinas's writings on overthrowing tyrants. By summer 1939, radical anti-Semitism was boiling across New York City, with splinter groups like Joe McWilliams's Christian Mobilizers holding massive rallies. Meanwhile, Dennis Healy, a railroad worker and National Guardsman, infiltrated the Christian Front for the FBI. Healy's home was wired as he met with Klaus Ernecke, who recruited him into the sports club or country gentleman, paramilitary cells preparing for revolution. Ernecke spoke bluntly, "We lose, we're dead. We win, we control the country." The country gentleman met weekly, with Cassidy, the Little Führer, often attending. Their activities escalated to firearms training where they shot at effigies of President Roosevelt. When Congress repealed the Neutrality Act in late 1939, allowing weapons sales to Britain and France, Cassidy exploded, threatening to knock off congressmen. The group began accumulating stolen military supplies through Captain John T. Prout Jr., including thousands of rounds of ammunition and explosives. They planned to bomb Jewish and communist targets in New York, hoping to incite the Jews and communists to riot so they could step in and take over the government. When the Christian fronters were finally arrested in January 1940, J. Edgar Hoover staged an elaborate show of force, motorcades, agents with machine guns, all nonsense in Cassidy's later telling. The 17 defendants hardly looked threatening in court, a collection of clerks, mechanics, and salesmen. Yet their arsenal included 15 partly completed bombs, military-grade rifles, thousands of rounds of ammunition, and explosives. "We expect more arrests," U.S. Attorney Kennedy warned. "We have merely scratched the surface." Despite damning evidence, including machine gun ammunition, improvised bombs, and bomb-making instructions, the jury hung on four defendants and acquitted the rest, including Cassidy, who immediately demanded the return of all the guns. 300 supporters erupted in cheers at the verdict. Father Coughlin called the conspiracy a hoax and dismissed the evidence as Gettysburg rifles, heirloom bayonets, and soup tin cans. At a celebration rally, defendant Botger boasted that at least 10 members of our jury are going to apply for membership in the Christian Front. The Christian Front story reveals how religious identity can be weaponized to justify political violence. By framing their anti-Semitism and anti-government activities as a defense of Christianity, they created a moral framework that justified extreme actions. This pattern, using religious identity to sanctify political violence, continues to plague American politics today. The Christian Front's acquittal also demonstrates how jury nullification can undermine justice when community sympathies align with extremist defendants. Isn't it troubling how little has changed in our vulnerability to religiously framed extremism? George Sylvester Viereck's propaganda operation reached deep into the halls of Congress, exploiting America's own democratic institutions to spread Nazi messaging. Upon returning from Berlin in 1939, Viereck approached Senator Ernest Lundeen, an old friend from World War I propaganda days who was already demanding kickbacks from his staff. Viereck offered Lundeen substantial payments to publish German-directed propaganda under the senator's name. Operating from Lundeen's Senate office, Viereck wrote speeches claiming Nazi atrocities were fabricated and that mysterious influences were maneuvering America into war. Lundeen's staff witnessed Viereck calling the German embassy for material and drafting speeches that Lundeen then delivered in the Senate. To distribute this propaganda nationwide, Viereck created the Make Europe Pay War Debts Committee, later Islands for War Debts Committee, with Lundeen as chairman, exploiting a loophole allowing congressional committees to use the franking privilege, free postage paid by taxpayers. The operation expanded to include other lawmakers, particularly Congressman Hamilton Fish, whose congressional frank was used to distribute Nazi propaganda materials. Fish, a towering 6'4" former football star, World War I hero with the Harlem Hellfighters, and scion of American political royalty, had embarked on a self-appointed diplomatic mission to Germany in 1939. There, Nazi Foreign Minister Ribbentrop hosted him, counting Fish as someone likely to collaborate with us. Fish avoided pressing Germany on its persecution of Jews, told reporters Germany's claims on Poland were just, and seemed to carry water for the Nazis. The extent of congressional involvement in distributing Nazi propaganda came to light through the work of Henry Hoke, a direct mail marketing expert who recognized a dangerous tide surging through America's postal system. Hoke published an expose titled War in the Mails in his industry newsletter, revealing how German agents were using American postal services to spread propaganda. Using his direct mail expertise, Hoke conducted forensic analysis of propaganda envelopes, tracing them to specific postage meters and congressional franking privileges. Washington Post reporter Dillard Stokes further exposed the operation when he discovered that 8 mailbags of evidence related to Nazi propaganda had been hastily removed from Fish's office and hidden in a house storeroom. The evidence trail led to Fish's secretary, George Hill, who had ordered the removal of the mailbags. When Stokes located the hidden bags in the Capitol building storeroom, they contained damning materials linking Fish's office to Nazi propaganda distribution. After Pearl Harbor and Hitler's declaration of war on America, the nation's tolerance for Nazi sympathizers evaporated. George Hill faced trial in early 1942. Though Fish publicly supported Hill, calling him 100% okay, the congressman carefully avoided the courthouse despite his name being frequently mentioned. Hill was convicted of perjury for lying about his relationship with Virek and hiding mailbags from investigators, receiving a minimum 2-year prison sentence. This congressional complicity in spreading Nazi propaganda raises disturbing questions about the vulnerability of democratic institutions to foreign influence. Elected officials used their positions and privileges to amplify messages from a hostile foreign power, all while maintaining plausible deniability. The episode demonstrates how easily democratic systems can be exploited when lawmakers prioritize ideology over national security. Doesn't this historical example make you wonder about contemporary foreign influence operations targeting American democracy? The mechanisms may have evolved, but the vulnerabilities remain disturbingly familiar. In January 1944, prosecutor O. John Raj brought a new indictment against 30 defendants for allegedly conspiring with Nazi Germany to incite revolution and mutiny in the United States. The trial quickly descended into chaos, with defendants employing disruptive tactics. Elizabeth Dilling once arrived wearing a gas mask, while another defendant repeatedly claimed illness to avoid proceedings. Defense attorneys filed endless motions, with the proceedings becoming a circus that frustrated the judge and accumulated enormous costs. Despite these obstacles, Raj began presenting compelling evidence. Dr. Hermann Rauschning, a former Hitler associate who had fled Germany in 1936, testified about Hitler's specific plans to paralyze the will and national unity of America by exploiting social divisions. Raj then called Henry Allen, a Silver Shirts member whose confiscated briefcase contained documents connecting nearly all defendants in a network promoting fascism and anti-Semitism, including plans for armed insurrection against Roosevelt's government. After 7 grueling months and 3 million words of testimony, the trial came to an abrupt end when Judge Edward Eicher died in his sleep on November 29, 1944. His death, likely hastened by the strain of the chaotic proceedings, effectively ended what Time magazine called one of the most ludicrous fiascos in the history of U.S. jurisprudence. Refusing to let the case die, Raj traveled to Germany, where he and his small team spent 11 weeks examining captured Nazi documents. His investigation uncovered explosive evidence of Nazi infiltration in American politics, including connections to prominent isolationist Republicans and other influential figures. When Raj submitted his final report to Attorney General Tom Clark, he was instructed to remove certain politically sensitive names, effectively censoring the document. Frustrated by these restrictions, Raj decided to speak publicly, revealing that Hermann Göring had confirmed Nazi efforts to influence the 1940 U.S. election, including funding for certain isolationist Republicans. This unauthorized disclosure infuriated Burton Wheeler and other implicated politicians who demanded action from President Truman. Attorney General Clark promptly fired Raj, claiming he had violated department policy by discussing confidential information. The epilogue reveals the post-war fates of key figures from America's fascist movement. Philip Johnson, despite his pro-Nazi activities, managed to evade serious consequences through powerful connections and reinvented himself as a celebrated architect, dismissing his fascist past as youthful indiscretion. Lawrence Dennis, the sedition trial defendant who had been passing as white, had been born Lonnie Lawrence Dennis to a black mother and white father, a former child preacher known as the colored boy evangelist, before reinventing himself. Father Charles Coughlin remained unrepentant about his anti-Semitic broadcasts even decades later. America's failure to fully reckon with its fascist movement has left a troubling legacy. Many key figures never faced consequences, with some continuing to spread extremist ideas for decades after the war. The abrupt end of the sedition trial and suppression of Raj's findings prevented a full public accounting of the extent of Nazi influence in American politics. This unfinished reckoning has allowed myths of American exceptionalism to persist, the comforting notion that fascism was a purely European phenomenon that never took serious root in American soil. The reality, as Maddow's research reveals, is far more complex and disturbing. Significant segments of American society, including respected political and cultural figures, embraced fascist ideologies and collaborated with Nazi Germany. The question that haunts us today, how different might our understanding of American vulnerability to authoritarianism be if this history had been fully exposed and reckoned with? By burying this history, we've perhaps made ourselves more vulnerable to similar movements in the present. As Maddow concludes, if we're willing to take the harder look at our American history with fascism, the truth is that our own story in this wild, uncertain 21st century has not an echo in the past, but a prequel. The story of those who fought American fascism before World War II offers guidance for our continuing struggle to protect democracy.